The Tom Woods Show, episode 587.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, if you are looking for more libertarian podcasts, then I recommend the Jason Stapleton program hosted by my friend Jason Stapleton. Monday through Friday, he gives you an hour's worth of libertarian analysis of the news of the day. Check it out at jasonstapleton.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here, talking to Matt Lewis today about the Republican Party. Now, Matt and I are not exactly from the same point of view, but that makes things fun. He's a good guy and a friend, and he's got a brand new book, and it's called Too Dumb to Fail: How the GOP Betrayed the Reagan Revolution to Win Elections and How It Can Reclaim Its Conservative Roots. Matt Lewis is a writer, a CNN political commentator, and a blogger with The Daily Caller. He's also a contributing editor for The Week. He currently hosts his own podcast, Matt Lewis and the News. He was named one of the 50 best conservative columnists by Right Wing News in 2013, 14, and 15. Matt, welcome to the show.
Hey, Tom. Great to be here. I'm a huge fan of the podcast and delighted to be on the show today.
Well, I couldn't be happier as well. We were just saying before we started that I've been on your show and I've used that appearance as an episode of this show. So I'll link that. If people just can't get enough of the Woods-Lewis rapport here, then we will give them more of what they want at tomwoods.com/587, where I'll link to
awesome
chat that I used as an episode of my own show.
No, I just want to say, not to suck up, but I'm a huge fan of the show. Love the history. I mean, you can learn from it. And the fact that you can have, you know, civil and smart discussions and not get mad at people if you don't 100% agree. It's so rare and so appreciated.
Well, I appreciate that. That's very kind. All right, let's talk about your book, Too Dumb to Fail. First of all, I don't quite understand the title. Explain yourself.
So this is the phenomenon whereby if a candidate or a pundit says or does something stupid or crazy, they actually go up in the polls. And it's also an allusion to the Andrew Ross Sorkin book, Too Big to Fail, about the financial crisis. In that case, you had these perverse incentives where financial institutions took on risks, and collectively we all ended up having to pick up the tab. And I see the same thing happening in the Republican primary, where you have these perverse incentives. If I'm a politician, I have an incentive to say or do something stupid. I'll go up in the polls, even though collectively I think conservatism and the Republican Party suffers. It's really the tragedy of the commons problem in game theory. And this is really happening with punditry. You know, when Ann Coulter calls Muslims ragheads, you know, she does well. She sells more books. She gets buzz and attention. But collectively, I think that it does harm conservatism and Republican candidates.
You know, I don't like political correctness any more than the next guy. And I think it's stifling and terrible and totalitarian. But I do encounter some people, especially conservatives, who feel like just being a boorish, disgusting human being is, you know, they're being unjustly put upon by political correctness. And so they're going to respond by just being boorish and over the top offensive. And I hate using the word offensive. It's such a girly word, frankly. But you know what I'm saying? I mean, that phenomenon is all over conservative punditry. I mean, Ann Coulter might even be the least of the offenders. A lot of these youngsters think that they're going to show how tough and conservative they are by showing how obnoxious and boorish they can be. I don't really want to deal with people like that. Like, that's their big issue. Can I be as obnoxious as possible? Like, that's your stand for liberty?
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more. I think, look, political correctness is run amok, and I hate the whole, like, word police people who are hypersensitive. And as George Carlin used to say, they want me to call that thing in the street a person hole cover. That is ridiculous. To me, it comes down to motives. What are your motives? If you are saying or doing something because you believe in free speech or because, frankly, you're just trying to communicate a message that you believe in, I'm okay with that. My concern is, I think there are a lot of people now, it's a cottage industry of people who who are, their motives are not pure, and actually it's selfish. They're attempting to be provocative and controversial, and if it hurts the conservative cause or the Republican Party, and by the way, I know, you know, I am a conservative. I do have some libertarian leanings, but I am a conservative, and I think that it's worth the fighting for. I think it's conservatism, you know, in the tradition of Edmund Burke and even Aristotle. It has a proud intellectual tradition, and it bothers me when people, I think, exploit it for their own personal gain.
I want to talk about how you begin the book. You give a very basic and brief overview of the history of the conservative movement in the United States, and then you get to the 1964 election. You talk about Barry Goldwater, and you say, and I'd like to hear you flesh this out, that this is where the seeds were sown for one of the problems that the conservative movement has today, which is a strain of anti-intellectualism. And you hasten to point out this is not something Goldwater himself would have wanted. Goldwater himself was a reasonably serious thinker. So what exactly do you mean by that? How did that come out of the Goldwater campaign as far as you see it?
Right. So I admire Barry Goldwater. And I mean, and if it wasn't for Barry Goldwater, you don't get Ronald Reagan. So I think that conservatives and Republicans, you know, at the time, of course. And by the way, this is the interesting thing, Tom. I'm old enough to remember when the establishment were these moderate, literally Rockefeller Republican liberal types. And now the establishment, I guess, is the Club for Growth somehow, you know. So while things have really changed, I do think one of the interesting things that happened in the 1964 campaign is that, you know, Barry Goldwater runs, and if John F. Kennedy had lived, it could have been a very high-minded campaign about ideas. There was talk about Kennedy and Goldwater traveling the country together, doing these kind of Lincoln-Douglas-style debates. But instead what happens is you have JFK assassinated, and you have Lyndon Johnson become the Democratic nominee, and he ran this scorched earth campaign. We all remember the infamous Daisy ad, where he went after Barry Goldwater and tried to cast him as this lunatic who would bring about a nuclear holocaust if he were elected. It was a really scurrilous and just horrific example of negative campaigning against Barry Goldwater. But what happens is after that race is over, Goldwater gets 38% of the vote, and I think he won six states. And a lot of the activists who had, you know, come out of the Goldwater movement, some of them actually disappeared. They became disenfranchised and frustrated. They left politics forever. But some of them actually decided, well, let's try to learn from this experience. Let's learn how we can win in the future. And they basically came to the conclusion that being right isn't enough to win, that being philosophically correct isn't enough to win, and that the way to win is to study political technology, how do you knock on doors? How do you run TV ads? How do you organize and communicate? And there's nothing wrong with that. That's very, you know, participation in democracy is very noble. And so a lot of the Goldwater folks who came out of it simply became better campaigners, better organizers. They started think tanks. They started training activists. But I do think there was a negative message that came out of that, which is that negative politics, it works, is that, you know, if they're going to accuse us of these horrific things, if they're going to bring a knife to a fight, we have to bring a gun. You know, they put one of us in the hospital, we put one of theirs in the morgue. And I think that really did sow the seeds of the beginning of this sort of dumbing down of politics. It's not about ideas. It's about campaigning and organizing.
Right, right. Yeah, I can see that. I can definitely see that. Now, I'm particularly sensitive about this claim about negative campaigning, because I think it really, really got started, that people really focused on negative campaigning and criticized it in the 1988 election, when you had George H.W. Bush and Mike Dukakis, because Bush ran this notorious ad about Willie Horton, who was a criminal who went on to, I don't know, commit some horrific crime while he was out on furlough under Mike Dukakis's prison furlough program in Massachusetts. And this was just declared to be totally out of bounds. But in general, I thought there wasn't enough negative campaigning, in the sense that I lived in Massachusetts. I knew the truth about Mike Dukakis. Nobody else seemed to, except those of us in Massachusetts. He was going around saying, we had this Massachusetts miracle of economic growth, and I want to bring that to America. What he left out was he vetoed and fought against every single leg of the program that gave us that economic growth. I mean, he was an obstacle that stood in the way of every good thing that had gone on in Massachusetts, and we wanted people to know that. How are you going to convey that without a negative ad?
Oh, totally. And I mean, you know, what's the alternative, right? Banning negative ads and stifling free speech and free expression. I mean, that would be the worst backlash. And I mean, as you know, negative campaigning's been around forever. You go back and look at what, you know, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson said about each other. In some cases, it makes today's politics look tame in comparison. But having said that, I do think it's part of the story about what happened to conservatism. I mean, there was a time when conservatism was actually considered to be too intellectual, too full of these, you know, whether it was Bill Buckley or Hayek or Russell Kirk, too populated by these, you know, these intellectuals who were, you know, removed from Joe's six pack, you know. And I think that this is the beginning of the story, at least of the modern story of how we go from the party of you know, the movement of Edmund Burke and the party of Ronald Reagan to Sarah Palin endorsing Donald Trump and giving that crazy endorsement speech about this is for holy rollers and rock and rollers. I think that's part of the story as to how we got to where we are today.
But at the same time, I think even though I think National Review has fallen, you know, to a much lower level than it used to be. I mean, imagine a magazine, whether you agree with these people or not, imagine a magazine featuring James Burnham, Russell Kirk, Frank Meyer, people like this on a regular basis. And I just don't think there's even a comparison to what they have today. But yet the Trump phenomenon is clearly a rebuke of this, of the conservative movement. Which I think some people view as still being too intellectual. It still has its think tanks. It still has its highbrow magazines. But we are here in the heartland, and we're connecting to this regular guy, multi-billionaire. But we're connecting to somebody who just is plain spoken and just doesn't give us the same old Mitt Romney talking points that we keep getting from you people every 4 years. I don't think we can just say, well, anti-intellectualism swept the board inexplicably, and now what are we going to do? These people are to blame. The product the conservative movement is serving up to the general public is not an impressive one.
Yeah, I think there's a whole bunch of factors that have culminated that help explain the rise of Donald Trump. Some of what I think is Barack Obama's disastrous presidency. Some of it, I think, is, you know, nominating people like Mitt Romney, who, you know, look, my dad was a prison guard. My dad would have probably held his nose and voted for Mitt Romney. But what was it? Mike Huckabee said something about, you know, I'm paraphrasing here, but it was like Romney doesn't remind you of your dad. He reminds you of the guy who fired your dad.
That's a good one.
I think I'm slightly off with the paraphrase, but it was somewhere in there, and it was pretty astute. So I think that there are a lot of people to blame. I love the fact that and I write about this in the book, the Frank Meyer fusionism. And the way that conservatism, you know, sort of came together and infused traditionalists and libertarians, and it was very diverse. And it's become, I think, less diverse, probably more of a neoconservative consensus, at least on foreign policy. And I think that's certainly part of the story. I do think that Donald Trump is tapping into an anger and a frustration out there. Mainly among working class white Americans who believe the American dream has left them behind. You used to be able to graduate from high school, get a factory job, make $15 an hour, provide a middle class lifestyle for your family. Those days are gone. You can blame automation. You can blame capitalism if you're on the Bernie Sanders left. You can blame immigration. You can blame you know, all sorts of things, globalization. There are a lot of boogeymen here that I think are partly responsible. But, you know, Tom, I've been listening to your podcast, and I share a lot of your concerns about Trump, even though I'm respectful of a lot of the good Americans. And by the way, you know, even the best of families have Donald Trump supporters. I among you know, I have a brother-in-law, for example, who's a Trump supporter, a great guy, a smart guy, I think misguided. I will say among the many concerns I have for Trump, I think I share with you the concern that he has these authoritarian tendencies that I find pretty troubling.
Well, I think it's part of his personality. And it is very much, I think the Teddy Roosevelt comparison is quite apt, because his personality was very much that of a dominating figure who cast himself as the personification of the will of the people. So why should I in any way honor any institution that's standing in the way of me and the implementation of the will of the people? So I see some of that in Trump. But, you know, I have to say, Matt, I am having trouble getting as agitated about Trump as other people are, simply because my question is always, what's the alternative? What's the alternative that's being presented to me in the race? Now, there is Ted Cruz, but Cruz and Trump are by and large struggling for the same block of voters. And that, as I had Dan McCarthy on the show a couple of days ago, talking about exactly that and saying that that's what's opening the door for Rubio.
Yeah.
Rubio has the rest of the field. He's got the establishment. He's got neoconservatives. He's got people who are just uncomfortable with Trump and Cruz. He's got that whole field almost to himself, and probably in a matter of days from now, just for all practical purposes, to himself. And when I look at Rubio, I just panic, because I see another George W. Bush. I see a guy not particularly bright who's going to be dominated by almost certainly the very bad people he's going to put around himself. And if I'm somebody who is supposed to respect Edmund Burke, then I just cannot imagine what the compatibility is between that and the idea that the United States was created to be a global democracy spreading human rights. I don't see that those are compatible.
Well, I would say that when it comes to foreign policy, I probably shake out most in the Ted Cruz camp. I'm somewhere in the middle. I think it's a Reagan space, actually. And I don't mean it to be a cop-out, but on one hand, I do believe that it's important for America to be, you know, this beacon of hope and to, you know, have a place in the world. On the other hand, I think that, you know, spreading democracy and adventurism is very dangerous. And there's really not much of a doubt that we're worse off now as a result of Iraq. I actually think Rubio, there is a lot that I like about Rubio. I think he has a chance to actually, he's incredibly eloquent. I love his story about the American dream. You know, when he talks about how his dad was a bartender and he says that journey from behind that bar to behind this podium is the essence of the American dream. I think it's powerful. I think that he's eloquent. I think it really resonates with a lot of Americans who aren't traditionally Republican or conservative. And I think that Rubio, if he were the nominee and if he were the president even, you know, has a potential to win over 21st century voters who I think might otherwise think of themselves as liberals, just sort of default liberals. And I'll tell you why. If you look at it's something I talk about a lot on when I talk about the book, but you know, the lady who gets on her smartphone and orders an Uber and, you know, goes someplace and gets on the smartphone and now orders a StubHub, she should be a conservative because she obviously doesn't like onerous governmental regulation. She's entrepreneurial. You know, she's probably managing her own stock portfolio. I find it hard to believe she's going to trust a big bloated bureaucracy to manage her retirement funds. So she should be conservative, and I think she will be as long as her idea of what a conservative is isn't this cultural, you know, shortcut of, you know, Boss Hogg with a rebel flag flying in the pickup truck. And I think Rubio appeals to these kind of Americans. And I think Rubio could make the argument that, look, what Hillary Clinton's selling is a 20th century command and control style assembly line version of liberalism. I think he's really kind of uniquely positioned to make that argument. I do share your concerns, however, and it's not a small thing. I do share your concerns about his foreign policy and his penchant for wanting to be involved in pretty much any skirmish. I think I would like to see maybe a Rand Paul in the administration whispering in his ear.
All right, let's pause for a brief message and come right back. Folks, I get a lot of requests from people. What am I going to listen to when I'm all done listening to the Tom Woods Show? What else is out there that I can listen to that will nourish me as a libertarian? And one answer I give is the Jason Stapleton program. It's hosted by my friend Jason Stapleton. Jason's been a guest on this show, and he runs that show Monday through Friday, just like me. But his show is an hour long every single day, and he sticks to current events. And he has a knack for taking complicated issues and explaining them in ways that the non-specialist can understand. So whether it's gun control or citizenship or the Greek bailout or some more technical and complex questions like that, he can explain it in a way that you can go out and argue the case with confidence. I was looking at some recent iTunes reviews of the Jason Stapleton program, and I found this one. There are many shows available that claim to enrich your life. The Jason Stapleton program actually delivers. Check it out at jasonstapleton.com. All right, we're talking about your book, Too Dumb to Fail, and you've got in here quite a few criticisms of different conservatives and different strains of conservatism and different what I think you consider to be dead ends in conservatism that are holding back its success. So pick one of those and let's talk about it.
Well, so much to talk about. I will say, you know, I started about 5 years ago is when I started noticing the dumbing down of conservatism. And it was when you had like Sarah Palin, whom I originally kind of liked, went rogue. And you had Christine O'Donnell and Sharon Angle running. And they were playing this, what I would call identity politics card. And they were playing this victim card, you know, like, woe is me. We can't, these people, the establishment's keeping us down. And really that cuts against what I think of as a conservative, a rugged individual, somebody who finds a way to succeed. And to me, that started this sort of dumbing down problem. I am concerned about that what's happened is we've lost sight of what real conservatism is. And what we have is this sort of these cultural shortcuts and what we think a conservative is. And we think it's sort of somebody who is, you know, whether it's rural or whether it's somebody who lives in a McMansion, somebody who has the rebel flag in their pickup truck or whatever. I'll just tell you one thing I read about in the book that's a weird departure maybe, but I find it. I think your audience would like it. Is new urbanism, and even though that word I don't love that term. I am a fan of this sort of Russell Kirk. You know, he talked about the car being the mechanical Jacobin, and this notion where, you know, if you're a conservative, you don't have to live in a McMansion in the suburbs. You know, one of the things that I enjoy is living in a walkable community where you can walk to church, walk to bars, walk to schools, walk to restaurants. And this is an idea that I really got turned on to by Rod Dreher in his book Crunchy Cons. So I know that's a lot of stuff to unpack. This maybe gives you a sense of how kind of far-reaching and I hope interesting this book is.
Well, it is an interesting book, and I have to say I find a lot to disagree with in it, but I also find a lot to agree with. And I think in many cases, the same annoying people annoy both you and me. So that's a very important thing to have in common. That stuff about the new urbanism is fine with me. I mean, I read about it in the American Conservative magazine, for example. They have representatives of that in there, and that's fine with me. I think that conservatism is really, though, so it is supposed to be fundamentally something that emerges that's small and local.
Right.
So
exactly.
That's an expression of that,
yep.
That you think about the actual neighborhood that I live
right.
in.
Right. But the interesting point is if you don't have a conservative worldview and if you're not familiar with that sort of Burkean, the little platoons, form of conservatism, you believe what is conservatism? Well, it's listening to Rush Limbaugh. It's driving a big SUV. It's throwing your McDonald's wrapper out the window when you're done or whatever the negative stereotype is. And I guess the point I'm making here is sort of illustrating that that real conservatism in a Burkean sense is really quite a departure. So when people – you know, this hasn't happened much. I've actually been really happy by the response of this book. It's been really well received by a lot of conservatives. I'm very happy with that. But the people who might say, like, well, Matt's a liberal or a rhino because he wants us to live in, you know, he wants to live in a walkable, you know, I don't want to tell anybody what to do. I don't think government needs to tell people where to live. But because I'm advocating this, these local community values, somehow that makes me a liberal. That just shows how far removed we are from actual, like, knowing what conservatism is.
Let's talk about Ted Cruz for a minute, if we might, because it's interesting that you mentioned an affinity for him in terms of foreign policy, because I would say that Cruz is an example of, I mean, he's an example of a populist in a way, because he does make a direct appeal over the heads of the party leadership right to the public. So he has the populist streak, but he's not one of these ignorant hayseeds that seem to drive you crazy, because there's nobody, even his worst enemy, who denies that he's very, very smart. He really knows what he's talking about, but he still has a populist style. So is it the populist style that offends you, or is it the populist style that has no substance behind it?
I would say the latter, but let me unpack this a bit, because there's a bunch of stuff to know. So first, I'm from a really rural community. When people said in school, what do you want to be when you grow up? The number one, like, kids raised their head, like, the number one answer was farmer. The number two answer was truck driver. My dad was a prison guard in Hagerstown, Maryland. That's kind of where I come from. And the reason that I don't like the Donald Trump thing is, honestly, I feel like it's exploiting a lot of the good, hardworking rural Americans that I grew up with. So it sort of viscerally bothers me, maybe in a way that if I was more cosmopolitan or Ivy League educated, it actually might not. I went to a little college in West Virginia. So these things hit us differently. I should probably also disclose that my wife actually was Ted Cruz's national fundraiser when he ran for U.S. Senate against David Dewhurst, back in 2012. So I just throw that out there for the sake of full disclosure. Look, I think that I have mixed feelings about Ted Cruz. I think that he is, you cannot deny he's a legitimate conservative. So unlike Ted Cruz, I'm sorry, unlike Donald Trump, I have no doubt that Ted Cruz truly is a movement conservative. I also think he's sanctimonious and in many cases has done things to advance his sort of ambition that have actually hurt conservatism. Look, if it weren't for Donald Trump, maybe Ted Cruz would be the villain in my book, Too Dumb to Fail. But in comparison to Donald Trump, you know, Ted Cruz looks like this really smart, eloquent, reasonable conservative. So I think that my opinion of Cruz has probably gotten better in comparison to Donald Trump's candidacy.
Let's talk about pundits in the conservative movement, because you have a subheading in one of your chapters. How to succeed as a pundit, parentheses, without really knowing anything. Ah, yes. I remember, and I feel like I shouldn't say the name, because I almost feel bad saying it, but there was a time in the past few years I was watching TV. There was a conservative pundit on who was so ignorant, so shockingly ignorant, that I actually opened up my computer and I said, I have to look up this person. I have to know what in the world got this person on television. So I know that there must be plenty of others. In fact, it surprised me. It even I was still naive back, I guess, about a dozen years ago. I was on TV with Sean Hannity. And he had never before heard the argument that the New Deal may have retarded the recovery from the Depression. Now, I know that's not the mainstream historical opinion of it, but it's not like, you know, there are no proponents of this view. This is the conservative view, and this was completely news to Sean Hannity. So it seems like – and I'm sure this is not exclusive to conservatism, although and we can find a lot of left liberals who are this way. I personally think libertarians tend to be more informed about stuff because they're less fixated on politics all the time. I think people like Hannity feel like they're really well informed if they know the poll numbers and they know what the candidates are doing. But he didn't know any of this stuff, and that just blows my mind. Yeah. That's our pundit class.
It's amazing. I won't mention a name here, but I was on a different network, and during a commercial break, I was talking to one of the other panelists, and I mentioned Schumpeter and creative destruction.
Oh, yeah. You may as well have been talking about quantum physics.
The host had no idea what we were talking about. And here's the scary part, Tom. I've actually found that in a way, the more you know, the worse you are on TV. Like knowing, having a lot of like information and nuanced opinions actually makes it harder to talk in sound bites that you need to do on TV. And I've actually feel like if you were to chart my career as a TV pundit, I started off, I think, pretty good because I didn't know anything. And then I actually went through a period where I wasn't nearly as good on TV because I like knew too much. And now I think I've finally figured out how to sort of incorporate what I know, but not talk too much. But look, this is why podcasts are so awesome. This is why I have my own podcast. This is why I listen to your podcast, because we can have this like long form, interesting discussions that you could never have on TV. Even on the most, I mean, maybe if it was like Charlie Rose or something like that, but there are very few shows where you could actually have like a really deep conversation, which frankly, I have to say, like as an author, it is so nourishing to the soul to actually get to talk about like the book, you know, it's so rare sometimes.
I agree with what you're saying about, when you know a lot, you feel sometimes the need to insert so much nuance. Well, but don't forget this small point, and then there's this, and I don't want to overstate that. That's something you just have to train yourself out of when you're on TV. Peter Schiff is very good at that. He's very smart. He can give you all kinds of detail. He can give you a great hour and a half lecture off the top of his head, which he did at the Mises Institute. He walked in, he looked at the topic for the first time, and then he just talked for an hour and a half, and everybody was completely spellbound. But he can go on TV, and he's got these brilliant analogies that are just perfect, and he can do it in sound bites, and he makes it look easy. But as you point out, it's actually really not particularly easy to do that.
Yeah.
So it's something you have to train yourself to do.
It is ironic. It is almost like a inverse relationship between how much you know and how good you are on TV sometimes.
Well, and I think partly, when you have political candidates who have memorized a lot of good one-liners, it makes them seem better than they really are, seem like they have greater depth than they really have. But I still say that it can be done. You can have smart people who are – I thought – even though I didn't agree with Bill Buckley all the time, I thought he had an excellent TV presence, and I thought he was pretty quick on his feet. I think Pat Buchanan is brilliant, and I think he can slice and dice you pretty well in 30 seconds. So there are exceptions to the rule, but unfortunately – it seems to be a pretty persistent rule. All right, so let's say it's a lightning round now.
All right.
And you've got to just tell me, give me four problems or four mistakes that you see conservatives making, and that if they corrected those mistakes, their fortunes would improve.
All right, so I don't know if I can get through four, but I'll give you a few. One, I think it's a mistake to double down on the populist thing. Right now there is a real temptation because there is a niche out there. There is an audience for somebody who will play what I will call working class white identity politics, and to feed the anger and in some cases understandable anger and frustration out there. But actually, a lot of the Donald Trump fans are really, if you look at the crosstabs, not really that conservative. They're for protectionism. They're for all sorts of things that are really unconservative. I think that, so number one, we have to resist this urge to immediately satisfy this demand, which I think in the short term might work. In the long term, I think would spell would be disastrous. Number two, I think it's incumbent upon us, those of us who are blessed to have a platform and a megaphone, to accept a certain, with great power comes great responsibility. And just because we have the ability to be provocative for the sake of being provocative and to be controversial, I think that we owe it to look. This isn't sports commentary. I mean, there are consequences to political rhetoric. Again, I'm not an advocate of political correctness at all, but I think we do need to be responsible. To have our motives be pure. So that's sort of summoning politicians and pundits, hopefully to our better angels. Those are two of the things that I would strongly urge is to resist these, to resist the perverse incentives out there. It's a quick fix, but we have to be better than that.
Let me say a quick thing about things being unconservative. The trouble that I keep identifying on the show here about the trouble with conservatism is that because it's not an ideology, and therefore because it's not like a set of hard and fast rules that every society in the world has to conform to, there are benefits to that, but the disadvantage is it's harder to say, well, this person's not a real conservative because X, Y, or Z. In terms of protectionism, I think of all kinds of people who have been cited as conservative heroes who favored protective tariffs. Everybody from Abraham Lincoln to Teddy Roosevelt to the presidents in the 1920s, which were supposed to be the most free
Calvin
markets.
Coolidge.
Yeah, and even Ronald Reagan himself. I mean, 100% tariff on some Japanese products. So I think it's hard to say that's just unconservative.
This is where my libertarian strain comes in. I'm a free market.
Okay, but then you have to say those people, maybe they are being conservative and they ought to be libertarian.
Yeah. Well, no, you're absolutely right. It becomes a game of semantics. I believe that maybe it's my brand of. And you're right. It's hard to define because there's not a dogma, and it makes it harder. I mean, I moderated a debate a year or so ago at Cato between the Cato interns and the Heritage Institute interns, and they don't declare a winner, but I can just tell you the Cato interns won, and I think it was because it was just easier for them to have a sort of a black and white position on this is what we believe, this is – you couldn't sort of say, yeah, but what if this happened or this – would you make an exception for this? I think the libertarian interns had a much clearer line as to what they believed in and what they didn't, and there was a lot more nuance. It goes back to what I was saying before about the problem of nuance in a debate. But no, you make a valid point. I clearly have some libertarian leanings. I'm a free marketer. I'm actually pro immigration reform. I believe things like we can grow the pie, that more people equals more prosperity. And that version of conservatism, my version, I believe is really the best for human flourishing. I think that it'll make more people. Lift more people out of poverty, make more people more prosperous, more happy, more joyful. I do not think it contradicts the definition of conservatism, which says that we are to conserve the good things about Western civilization. But no, you make a valid point that it's hard to define conservatism, and in some cases, it's in the eye of the beholder.
All right, a couple quick things before we wrap up here. In terms of more people means more prosperity, that certainly was the Julian Simon argument,
right?
That human beings shouldn't be thought of as burdens because look what's between, look what's in that skull up there, right? They've got the potential to do extraordinary things. They should be thought of as a resource, not as a burden. But at the same time, it kind of depends on who the people are because it's certainly – theoretically conceivable that we could be talking about people who consume more than they produce. And if people consume more than they produce, how is more people going to produce more prosperity? So I don't think it can just be arbitrarily stated that, more people are going to – it's not necessarily the case. There are plenty of places in the world where more people is not producing more prosperity. Secondly would be, what about Pat Buchanan? Now, he was a populist in the 1990s, and he ran a couple of memorable campaigns against – he ran against a sitting president in 1992, a sitting Republican president, and then he ran in 96 and he won the New Hampshire primary, and he was clearly running a populist kind of campaign. Yes, he was a protectionist, and I don't agree with that, but there are – it's funny. The Cato Institute people who will condemn you all day long for being a protectionist, they don't mind cozying up to central bankers and warmongers and whatever, so I'm not going to let them lecture me about my support for Pat Buchanan. I like Pat, and I actually do think he wanted to slash government way more than these fake movement conservatives say. They just want to raise money with their fundraising letters. I think he really wanted to do it, and I frankly loved his style, where he just slashed and burned. He had a good mind. He could give you a good intellectual argument, but he could also give the establishment a black eye. Why should I not find that thrilling? Why should I instead say, I wish he had written a 10,000-word essay for National Review? Explain that.
Well, I guess first let me just start by saying I like Pat Buchanan a lot personally. Just to share, I don't want to betray any trust here, but I've been around places where Pat has, worked and done TV commentary. And if you ask the makeup artists and the drivers, the sort of the regular people who make TV shows happen, who's the nicest to you? It's Pat Buchanan.
Yeah, I've heard that so many times.
It is. One story was he asked, there was a company who was doing some sort of service, without giving it away, for one of the networks. And Pat sent at Christmas a check to every single – a Christmas card, and I think it was a $500 check to every single person who worked at this company. And this is a very, you know, racially diverse company. And these are hardworking Americans who might think that Pat Buchanan's this horrible, like, fascist, you know, evil old white guy. And Pat was, you know, whereas a lot of the liberals, you'll hear, I'm not going to mention names, but you'll hear that they're not always so nice to working people. Pat has a well-deserved great reputation for being a super nice guy. I also think he's like really good on TV. And I have to say, like, I don't know if it shows through, but there are probably like two or three people that I've tried to look to, and I don't want to say mimic, but model my TV commentary on. And Pat, it was probably like Tucker Carlson, my boss, Pat Buchanan, and PJ O'Rourke are like three of the people that I think really, in very different ways, I admire and do it well. Having said that, as much as I admire Pat, and he's been on my podcast, you know, we just disagree in terms of our worldview. There's no doubt he's a solid conservative, that he fits well within the Reagan umbrella of what constitutes a conservative in good standing. We just happen to be on very different ends. You know, I'm sort of a libertarian free market guy. That's what I believe brings most prosperity. I don't think we can build a wall and basically stop globalization and protect the so-called good old days when, you know, in the wake of World War II, after all of our competition had been destroyed, where we can go back to those days where, you know, the factory job, the $15 an hour factory job is viable. You know, I think that if you look, I think a lot of the sort of glamorization of those halcyon days are actually misleading as well. I've heard, you know, I don't know if you ever listened to Russ Roberts' podcast, which is great.
Yeah, once in a while.
Econ Talk. A lot of the numbers are misleading. You know, our ability today to buy really good products at a cheaper rate because of free trade, you know, David Ricardo's comparative advantage, that helps make us all more prosperous. You know, in many ways, the numbers are skewed. There's a perception that we were so much better off somehow in like the 1960s and 70s. And in many ways, we're much better off today than we were back then.
All right. Your website, tell people what your website is.
Well, I have a little website of my own, mattklewis.com. But I'm actually a writer for the Daily Caller. And I contribute at a lot of places, including the London Telegraph, Roll Call, the Daily Beast, theweek.com. But if you want to listen to my podcast, it's called Matt Lewis and the News. And I've had great guests, including Thomas E. Woods and Patrick J. Buchanan.
And they can find the podcast also at mattklewis.com?
Yep, mattklewis.com and or on iTunes.
Now, I, being an oldster like you, I get the Matt Lewis and the News reference. I assume this is a play on Huey Lewis and the News, which
yes.
My listeners won't even know who that is.
The scary part is we are now getting to an age where, like, people have no idea what the reference is.
You don't know who Huey Lewis is? Come on.
I got to tell you, that sports album with the Heart of Rock and Roll on it is a great album. And then Power of Love, you know, the Back to the Future theme song. Listen, I challenge you, listen to those lyrics. It's a very uplifting and positive song.
Oh, look, that was like the soundtrack of our childhood, those songs, right?
Yeah, I know you're a prog rock fan.
Yeah, but this stuff, I mean, my kids will tell you that when I'm in the car and I don't have the iPod on, you know, we have Sirius XM. I got it on 80s on 8 all the time. You know, my kids haven't got the slightest idea what music is being produced today. They're never exposed to it. They never had a chance. You know, the other kids are talking to them about stuff they've never even heard of. And in a way, that's kind of the way I like it. But
yeah, just keep them away from Taylor Swift and keep them listening to Huey Lewis. And they'll probably grow up with some good values.
Yeah, they're doing okay. So far, so good. All right, Matt, I appreciate your time today. Best of luck. The book, once again, is Too Dumb to Fail, How the GOP Betrayed the Reagan Revolution to Win Elections and How It Can Reclaim Its Conservative Roots. Always fun talking, Matt. Thanks.
Thanks, Tom.
All right, that will do it for this week. Remember, I have a secret coupon page that only you folks know about for LibertyClassroom.com, where we're adding courses now at breakneck speed. These are all courses you can listen to when you're on the go. And they're on. This is not the Ron Paul curriculum. That's a totally different thing. This is like an adult enrichment site where you can learn from me and Bob Murphy and Kevin Gutzman and Jeff Herbiner and Brian McClanahan and regular guests of the show who all have PhDs and all have academic track records. And they're going to teach you the history and the economics you should have gotten in school, but we all know we didn't. And check out my special coupon page. It's at libertyclassroom.com/coupons. And then you just go to the homepage, libertyclassroom.com, and you use those babies and get yourself a discount. So that's your weekend assignment. We'll see you on Monday. We're going to have some debate analysis, so don't miss that.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.